And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood and masculinity, family, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hello, everybody.
And our guest today is Dr. Charlie Cork, who is one of Australia's leading intensive care specialists. He's currently president of the College of Intensive Care of Australia and New Zealand. He's the regional clinical lead for the Advanced Care Planning Program and the originator of the My Values Approach to Advanced Care Planning. Dr. Cork lectures widely on medical communication and end-of-life decision-making, and he was featured on the ABC in the film In the End. Charlie, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Charlie, your book helps to make something we avoid talking about, planning for your own death, into something that's interesting and thought-provoking. Is it addressed to any group in particular?
I think it's addressed to mainly to older Australians, but equally to their families who are involved in these decisions, because often the decisions need to be made by the next generation. When people become very sick, doctors look to the next generation or the relatives to make a decision. So really it's something for everybody. We can't avoid dying and we can't avoid death in our families. It's a natural part of life, and it's something we all need to think about and be able to do, to tackle.
Yes, we often hear that a lot of men are not good communicators, and I guess this applies particularly in medical situations. What is the current situation at these end-of-life situations?
Yes, that's an interesting observation. In our advanced care planning, we do find that about two-thirds of the people who come are women, and a lot of the men who come because their partners and their wives make them come. So it isn't a thing that men think about as much as women.
And yet, with modern medicine, people can effectively be kept alive in some sense of the word indefinitely, can't they?
Because letting go is about having this decision about when you actually stop. If you have an attitude that you're never going to stop, then we now, with medical technology, have the capacity to go on really rather a long time. And in many cases, it's probably too long. So we do need to actually know when to stop and to think about that and work out how we're going to do that. And that's really what all the stories in the book are about.
The natural assumption that most people, if they're in a healthy state, and most doctors would probably say, well, keep on living. Why wouldn't you do that? What are the factors that you think would stop a person wanting to keep on living in that way?
Well, I think that we all want to carry on living while things are okay, but not all of us, actually. There's a tough little group that don't have any worries about it and just want to try and live forever and are prepared to tolerate a lot. But for most of us, we can envisage situations that wouldn't be tolerable for us. And so it's a case of trying to define those and trying to share those with our families and to make some lines in the sand about what's too much for us. And we can do that probably at any time. And in fact, the evidence is that if you do that earlier, it's a bit easier than if you leave it. If you leave it too long, it becomes very complicated and very difficult.
And you set out a lot of these factors in your wonderful book called Letting Go, How to Plan for a Good Death. I think you sometimes sum it up in, you're going to go, do you want to go comfortably, or do you want to fight to the very last breath and no matter how much pain it causes you?
Yes, cure and comfort, I suppose. Yes, how much you... And we've often got that. The difficulty is the idea that the doctors and your family will clearly know when something's futile. Modern medicine makes that really, really difficult. There's rarely nothing we could try. The point is that what we try might not have much chance of working, and it may be very miserable, but I bet you we can think up something.
In a situation where the decision is made that this life is not worth continuing in the same way, say in an intensive care ward, can the family override what the person has directed?
Time. And this is what I find fascinating and was one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is that I have sat in so many meetings where I have said, you know, what would Bill have wanted? And they tell me, and they say, and I actually have a line of saying, if he was sitting here in the chair, what would he say? And they go, he'd say, this is bloody stupid. What the hell are you doing? I don't want this. And then you say, okay, so what should we do? And they go, treat him. do it. And you say, well, why? And they say, well, we want you to. We think that, you know, he should be given a chance. So there's a big gap between what as families are driven to do and what people want. And which is really fascinating.
Yes, and sometimes it comes out very clearly, doesn't it? Like, you must stay fighting for the family's sake or for your children's sake or something like that. They put pressure on the person.
Oh, yes. You bet. Mm. So, actually, the book's about how we can respect what people want and how people can get their message across. So a lot of the people that are buying the book are buying it for their family, you know, for their sons and daughters, particularly sons, because sons are much tougher than daughters. Quite often, you know, the daughter will say, Mum would never want this, and the sons would say, Mum deserves it. You know, Mum deserves a chance. She's a fighter. We must do it. Mm. So actually being able to have that discussion with family, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to be a communication about how people are thinking and help that discussion, which a lot of people want to have. And certainly my auntie tried to have it with me and I wouldn't listen to her. You know, and she was quite cross with me for not listening to what she was wanting. And I was saying, oh, no, you're not sick, you're not going to die. And she said, no, of course I am. And she was more sensible than me, really, then.
Well, these days, yes, the doctors are put in that situation where they have to make the decision. There may not be family around, and it must be very difficult for a doctor to live with that decision one way or the other.
It is very difficult, but most people have family. And most families are pretty much wanting to be involved. And some families are very clear and helpful, and other families are a complete mess. And you can imagine today with broken families, it can be really difficult because people, you know, don't like each other and they're very separated. And in a crisis, they all turn up and they've all want to have a say.
Now, you make a clear distinction in your book between this end-of-life decision-making and euthanasia. What do you see as the differences, euthanasia being a very controversial topic at the moment?
Yes, well, the main thing for most of us is that what most of us would like to do is to live our lives as well as we can and enjoy our lives up until the time that some obvious crisis comes at the end where we will duck out without making a mess of it. That's our general plan for most of us. And we don't really want to bring it on quicker than that. We just want to pick the point where we should not be silly. That's really what's in the book. I see euthanasia as a separate thing where people want to accelerate things. And in fact, there's not many people that want to do that. There are a few, but generally most of us don't want to do that. Most of us want to hold on as long as it's okay. But we are a little bit concerned about that end bit, that we could make a bit of a mess at the end. And I think many of us can think up situations where where others have made a mess of it, and we'd rather do better than that.
Yeah, so your book applies to a large proportion of the population these days where people have a life expectancy of, say, over 80, whereas I think you quote the number of people interested in euthanasia is actually quite small.
It's very, very tiny. No, very tiny. And even in the places that have it and have had it for some years, that it's still only a tiny proportion of the population who actually use the legislation. And even more interesting, of those who use it and actually, you know, start the process, very few of them follow through. Mm. So it's a bit, you've got to be very tough to do it and very determined. And most of us are not that determined. We just want to, you know, not make a mess of it, that's all, at the end bit.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Charlie Cork, who is the author of a new book called Letting Go, How to Plan for a Good Death. Charlie, we might just take a short break here, and we're going to listen to a song by Brian Cadd and the Bootleg Family, and it's called Let Go.
Heart. It's happened before. Don't come to me. I don't want no part. Let go. It ain't worth it if it hurts you. Let go. You don't need
place for urgent love. Gives a feel that it's all unreal, it's from up above. Telling some small secret dream and dreams by phone. Terrified there'll be a time she won't be alone.
And that was Let Go by Brian Cadd and the Bootleg Family. And we're speaking today with Dr. Charlie Cork, who is the author of Letting Go, How to Plan for a Good Death. Charlie, you discuss in your book the importance of values and what is important to a person, what matters most. I wonder if you could just talk to us a bit about what you mean by that expression and how that's used to determine these end-of-life wishes.
It's important to know what makes somebody's life really valuable and really worthwhile. And conversely, when those things are gone, when life is not worth living, because it's all a balance about what you're prepared to go through in relation to what you're getting back and when that balance is lost. So understanding someone and how they tick is really important, and it allows us to deliver medicine in a way and care in a way which is really focused on that person. So you may get someone whose values are that fighting is really important and that living in whatever condition, providing you're alive, is miraculous and wonderful. And that tells me something very important about how to address that person's illnesses as they come. Somebody else may have a thing that dignity is terribly important, and that the thought of having their bottom wiped by somebody else or being fed like a baby, you know, is terrible. And that sort of thing is such an indignity that they're really offended by it. So those two people are going to be very, very different in how they respond to the same thing. So for one person it's a miracle, and for other person it's a nightmare. So that's what we're beginning to try to understand. And the importance of that is that actually people stay, which of those people you are tends to be a lifelong thing. You don't really change. That's about you and understanding you and what makes you tick. So I like that. I think it's really important. And it allows us to give care to someone that doesn't offend them, but actually addresses what they want and how they feel.
And as you point out in your book, it's important to be clear and precise in what your intentions are, and making a general statement such as, I want to maintain contact with my family or be able to be in contact with my family, and, for instance, I don't want to be a vegetable, they're not clear enough, really, to give the good guidance that you want.
No, they're a start, and they give you something, but they don't give you enough. So if we just take the communication thing, for some people, communication means what we're doing now, and we're having an intelligent conversation, and we're chatting about things. But for other people, a squeeze of the hand or a blink of the eye is an amazing communication. It's, a linkage between people, and it says an enormous amount. So when I say communication, I need to be clear whether I'm talking about what we do, this end or the other end. How far down that track is meaningful communication that matters? Mm-hmm. And where does it become frustrating and unacceptable? So we need a lot more detail about what it is that we're talking about in order to make good decisions.
And having made those good decisions, if the person is unconscious, you may need an agent, and you talk about that and choosing an agent. But yes, in choosing an agent, it's important that you get the right agent. And some people just choose the eldest child. I have some experience of this, and it's not necessarily the right person to be making those decisions.
No, choosing a good agent is really, really, or medical decision maker is really, really important. So thinking about who's a good decision maker in all sorts of other areas of life. So it's the sort of person who's able to work with the information they've got and come to a decision based on balancing the evidence and then to live with that decision. So I see a number of people who are appointed who don't listen to others. They already know what the answer is before any information comes in, and that's a disaster.
Mm.
I also know people who've done it who then worry about it for years. No, a worrier, someone who makes a decision and then worries about it. That's mean to appoint them as a decision maker. So in my family, I've appointed my eldest daughter as my decision maker, not because I don't trust my wife, but I think that she loves me too much to be a great decision maker, and that's a nice thing. But it's a worrying thing for me, and I think my daughter is a more emotionless decision maker, which I see as a credit to her. My other younger daughters are much more artistic, and they worry about things a lot more, and I think that they would struggle with the decision making, and they've told me that they would. So just thinking like that and picking somebody, and the other important thing is, once picking someone, is telling the others that you love them very much. You haven't not picked them because you don't love them. You've not picked them because you're protecting them, and because you respect the harsh decision making of the other person, or not harsh, but the pragmatic decision making processes of the other person. And it's not about love, because if people think that you've not picked them because you don't love them, then they really hate it.
And sometimes the person might have that clear understanding of what the wishes of the patient were, but then there's the battle with some doctors, isn't there? The doctors have this natural predisposition to want to save and cure the patient.
Well, we do. That's exactly. That's what medicine is. And in order not to do it for doctors, you have to recognise that it's terribly difficult. And so doctors need huge permission to step back and not do all this stuff. And so they want a very clear message from the patient through the family, or through the elected family member. But for me, when I hear from a family member supported by all the other family members with a very clear plan that's consistent with the way someone's lived their life and what mattered to them in their life, and hopefully and possibly there's a doctor involved who also backs up that message, it can be very clear and very organized, and I like that. It's I see that a bit like those those perfect dives that don't have any splash. You've done it beautifully. It's just lovely. So it can be done beautifully, and it's nice when you see it.
And perhaps some people worry. You talk about people having a bit each way, but people might worry that they will change their mind. They might come up with a plan when they're say 60, and by the time they get to 80, they might think, I don't really agree with what I said when I was 60. How do you get around that problem? Is that what you're saying? It's a lifelong way of approaching it.
I think it's a bit simpler if you think about what you want in terms of who you are and how you feel. Then I do think that stays much the same. But as time goes by, how you implement, how firmly you want to implement things may change, and we all have the right to change our plan. Also, when we make the decision through a surrogate decision maker, that decision maker can be given different instruction as time goes by and needs reassurance of change so that they know that they're up to date and that they're, you know, on the right track. Mm. But I think that it's the idea that we change massively right at the end, I think that's a bit overplayed. You can do, but people don't do 180. You know, you don't suddenly change things very much in life. You tend to stay the same person.
Dr. Cork is speaking here with 20 years of experience, so I think we can accept that as very good advice. We probably need to change things in the community. Like, we see CPR machines in all sorts of places. I've seen one in our local library, for instance. Maybe some people wouldn't want to be revived with the librarian on a CPR machine.
Well, that's right. And I think it's hard because we've got systems now that are out there for everybody, and it's hard to actually, in that sort of situation, identify that you don't want things acutely. So that's become a bit of a problem, to how we stop the thing working so efficiently to save everyone everywhere and rush everybody to hospital. That really is part of that community education, is why I wrote Letting Go, because I felt that I was seeing such a lot of distress in relatives in the hospital, you know, struggling with these decisions, with very poor information from their relative and not really understanding what they were demanding and what they were thinking. But equally, I didn't think that I should say what I think. I really have tried to share lots and lots of stories which I hope convey the issues in a way that's interesting and humane and just allows that education to get out there.
And you have done that. And as Annabelle Crabb said after reading the book, this book should start 1,000 conversations. I want to give it to everyone I know. And I endorse exactly what Annabelle's said, but we've reached a stage of the program where we ask our guests to pick a song, and so Charlie, I wonder which song you've picked and why you picked it.
I chose Sarah Blasco, Hold On My Heart. I think she's a great Australian singer. I think she just has a nice emotional level, and she relaxes me and makes me think about the things that matter.
Strong, got a feeling that you survive.
And that was Sarah Blasco singing Hold On My Heart, the choice of our guest today, Dr. Charlie Cork. Charlie, we want to thank you very much for being on the program and congratulate you on your book called Letting Go, How to Plan for a Good Death. It just remains me to thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me, and I really hope that the book helps a lot of people. That's my desire.
I'm sure it will achieve that. And if you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, you can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. And send us a message. We'd love to hear from our guests. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.